Hello and welcome to Criminal Justice Knowledge. My name is Natalie Miller and I'm very pleased to welcome my guest today, Dr. Joanna Amoureux. She's the coordinator of the Criminal Justice Degree Program here at Humber, as well as teaches in the Criminal Justice Degree Program. Thank you very much for joining me today, Dr. Amoureux.
Thank you for having me.
So today we're going to be talking about terrorism, something that we hear a lot about in the news, that people think they know a lot about. But what is really the criminalization of terrorism? What are some specific offenses as part of the criminalization of terrorism?
Okay. So the criminalization of terrorism's specific offenses is something that we have seen post 9/11. Mm-hmm. So a lot of scholars who are studying terrorism look to 9/11 as a specific turning point in how it was that we created resources to proactively prevent terrorist incidents. So I'll start by asking a question. Do you remember where you were on September 11th, 2001?
I do, yes. I was in grade 5 in class.
I was in grade 10 French class at that time. And it's one of those moments where if you ask people where they were for our generation, they'll mm-hmm. be able to tell you, similar to how our parents or grandparents' generation could tell you where they were when JFK was shot. Everyone remembers where they were when they found yep. out that that happened. Mm-hmm. So prior to 9/11, Canada and many other countries, including the US, New Zealand, Australia, did not have specific criminal code offenses that were specific to terrorist-related offenses. They used general criminal offenses like conspiracy, like treason sometimes, mm-hmm. Homicide-related offenses, to prosecute terrorism-related offenses, and the terrorism aspect could be taken into consideration as an aggravating factor at sentencing, but there weren't specific terrorism-related
right.
offenses. Prior to 9/11, the United Kingdom was one of the only countries worldwide that had specific terrorism-related offenses, and that's a direct result of their experience with the IRA and the ongoing history mm-hmm. of terrorism that they've experienced in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. So in 2000, the United Kingdom introduced the Terrorism Act, which updated some of these criminal offense classifications. In the Canadian context, we did not have terrorism-specific offenses, but following 9/11, by December 2001, 93 days after the incident occurred, Canada introduced terrorism-specific offenses into its criminal code. It was one of the quickest pieces of legislation to ever be moved through and one of the quickest additions to the criminal code that we've ever seen. So what this did and what the intent of this was to provide police services with the resources to proactively prevent terrorist incidents mm-hmm. and then to provide the court system with a way to respond to terrorist-specific incidents. So with the introduction of these offense classifications, we saw things like participating in a terrorist activity, preparing for terrorist activity, mm-hmm. harboring or concealing individuals who were planning to participate in terrorist activity, giving instructions to participate in terrorist activities, and a lot of offenses related to financing. In Canada, we right. tend to follow the money when it comes to terrorism-specific offenses. So all of those offenses were added to the criminal code in 2001, and there's been subsequent revisions and further additions over the past 17 years. We didn't see the use of criminal or terrorism-specific criminal offenses utilized in those first 5 years after they were introduced into the criminal code. And one of the reasons for that is because in Canada, we tend to use immigration law. And we've relied right. on immigration law quite extensively to respond to terrorist threats. One of the reasons is that if you have someone who you suspect might be involved in a terrorism-related offense who's not a Canadian citizen, you can actually hold them without charging them under immigration law. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a different way to neutralize a threat. In the United Kingdom post 9/11, they relied on immigration law quite extensively and they were holding individuals for extended periods of time. This was actually in 2005, I believe, became a human rights right. violation. They went to court. The legal case was called the Belmarsh litigation, and they said that it was a violation of human rights to hold people mm-hmm. for undetermined periods of time because you deem them to be a threat. Mm-hmm. The other way that immigration law has been utilized is to deport people. Mm-hmm. So if you think that they pose a terrorist threat or a safety to Canadian citizens and you can remove them, then that's something that Canada has done historically. Mm-hmm. The first offense, or the first individual who was successfully prosecuted using terrorism-specific offenses, was Khawaja, and I never say that right, so if someone knows how to say it right, please let me know. And the interesting thing is that this individual was not engaged in a terrorist activity or plotting a terrorist activity here in Canada, but in the United Kingdom. So this individual was providing the technology to remotely detonate explosive devices for a major terrorist plot that was thwarted in the United Kingdom. Since then, we've seen the Toronto 18 prosecuted with some terrorism-specific offenses, although we could do another, you know, conversation about that, as many of those individuals had their charges stayed against them for various reasons. And we've seen people charged under the newly implemented offenses in the last 6 years of traveling abroad to participate in terrorist activities. But it's really been a shift in the last 17 years as to how we respond to terrorist activities. Given the recent incident that happened in Toronto last month, I think it's interesting that the Canadian press and police services didn't rush to identify that as a terrorist attack. I think that's appropriate. But one thing that's interesting when we're thinking about the legal definition of terrorism in Canada is Canada actually has one of the broadest, if not the broadest, definition of terrorist activity of anywhere in the world, including the U.S.
Wow.
So any activity that is ideologically, politically, or religiously motivated can fall under the definition of terrorist activity in Canada. And when it was first introduced, there was a huge amount of criticism for this and a huge amount of fear that individuals who were engaging in Indigenous political activism, particularly around land claims, were going to be able to be charged with terrorism-specific offenses because that type of activity technically could fall under that umbrella. So we haven't seen that happen yet, but who knows what will happen in the future.
It could always be.
Yeah.
Is there a way that Canada or that we're currently doing to reduce terrorism? We hear a lot about these terrorist organizations, and of course that's media also fear-mongering as well. But is there a way that we can reduce the incidence of any of this occurring, or is it kind of one of those things?
Well, that's a difficult question. And Canada does have a, and I can't remember the name of it specifically, but they do have a specific terrorist action plan. And I always confuse the UK, because I did a study on the UK in my PhD, and Canada's approach. But there's sort of a four-pronged approach, and they're very similar across Canada and the UK, and that is they want to prevent, detect, deny, and respond. And there's a large amount of resources that are funneled into being able to do this within the Canadian context. Public safety is a key interest, obviously, of the Canadian government. When we think about terrorist activity and how the criminalization of terrorism-specific offenses provided resources to proactively prevent, if we look at Canada over the past 17 years, they've actually been quite successful in doing that. We think about the Toronto 18, we think about the Ottawa bomb plot, the Via Rail bomb plot, the Victoria Day bomb plot. Those are instances where police services were able to gather intelligence and collect evidence to then disrupt that incident. What we're seeing now are more individuals acting by themselves, which is what we typically refer to as lone wolf terrorists, who are radicalizing online and who are not in communication with other people about their actions before they engage in them. The police and public safety will never be able to stop that. You can't police the internet, which we know to be true. And if someone is radicalizing and they're not speaking to other people about it, you're never going to have the opportunity to intervene. And that's what we've seen more and more of in the last 5 years, is individuals acting sometimes independently or having been in communication with people online, but not so much in person. And that becomes incredibly difficult to disrupt.
Yeah, exactly. But it does sound like we, as in Canada and around the world, are really doing a lot of good work. We could talk about this topic for a while. It's such a hot button topic, especially in today's age. But I want to thank you very much again for coming on the podcast. And until next time, I'm Natalie Miller, and this has been Criminal Justice Knowledge.